Macro Trading Floor.
With me, Alfonso Peccatiello, founder of the Macro Compass and former head of investments at a large European bank.
And I am Brent Donnelly, president of Spectrum Markets. I've been a portfolio manager, day trader, and market maker at the biggest commercial and investment banks in the United States. I'm also the author of Alpha Trader and The Art of Currency Trading. If you want to know what's going on in markets and where they're going, you found the right podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of the Macro Trading Floor. Alf speaking, and we recorded this episode before the non-farm payrolls. So in case you hear me or Brent say something stupid, just bear in mind that we can say stupid stuff, but this was recorded before NFPs. Brent, how are you doing?
I'm not bad. I also was playing poker till 2:30 a.m. last night, so another reason I might say something stupid, but there's a lot going on. So I think let's try to catch everyone up and look ahead. I think the main story to me is rates, right? Everyone's standing up on the top of the cliff looking down at the water, but nobody wants to jump. Everyone's looking at each other saying, you go first. No, no, you go first. You go first. And we saw that with Bank of Canada, ECB. Sorry, go ahead, Alf.
No, I was about to say, I agree with you, because the fun thing is that all central banks are trying to say that they don't wait for the Fed. We just said Lagarde, right? And then she was like, no, what do you mean? I'm not looking at the Fed. I mean, I'm the ECB, right? I'm going to do whatever I want. And then she says, wink, wink, June, by the way. Yeah? In June, we'll have a lot more information. And then, yeah, well, I think the Fed is also probably starting in June with the data we have today. So I guess everybody's basically been waiting for the Fed.
Right. And it's interesting because the economic paths are so different in the different countries. But then you have a lot of similarities too, especially in the jobs market and with wages being somewhat sticky in a lot of countries. So everywhere kind of has an excuse. I think that's also part of the issue with, they say that they're data dependent, but then the myriad or like the cornucopia of data is so extensive that if you want to be a little bit more hawkish, you can always find something. Or if you want to be a little bit more dovish, you can always find something. This week we had the Bank of Canada, which I thought would be more dovish, given that inflation's coming off and they're starting from a pretty weak starting point with GDP, especially very weak considering the population growth there. But they held the line as well. So again, it looks like everyone's kind of like on your marks, get set. But then while the market had priced March at one point for all the banks, now it's kind of moving back to April, May, June. Actually, the Swiss National Bank will be an interesting one because they have pretty much the lowest inflation. They have a pretty strong currency and they tend to follow the ECB. So everyone generally follows the Fed, although I think sometimes that can be overstated. Like there have been these little mini cycles. For example, like the Bank of Canada has had little mini cycles where they went away from what the Fed was doing. But generally, everyone follows the Fed. And then ECB is obviously the next major one. And then the SMB follows the ECB very closely. So if they were to cut in March, I think that would be really interesting. The market has a pretty decent sized short Swiss position. So if they don't cut, then there'll probably be some pain.
Yeah, you caught me. I'm short Swiss franc for a bit. long the yen against it. And we should talk about Japan because I think we have had now a few headlines in a row, which we haven't had in a while, that point towards the Bank of Japan seriously considering hiking. Now, disclaimer, we have had semi-serious headlines about the Bank of Japan considering hiking for a year, and they never did. So maybe this is the right time, though, because I think they mentioned wages as by far the key component in their thinking. And in Japan, once a year, there is this thing called the Shumto negotiation. Sounds very Japanese, Shumto. And yeah, it's basically like labor unions, right? They go and negotiate their annual wage increases for their workers. And, you know, the first indications coming out are pretty strong. Like you're getting wage deals done at over a percentage points higher than last year, which were already at the highs of a few decades. So I think wage growth is picking up now. You have more information about it. And also you have a couple of reasonably, trustworthy banks in Japan calling for the Bank of Japan moving. And you have a few officials as well. So then all in all, probably this is the time.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the Japanese banks changing their calls is important. And this has been such a slow process. So like they tend to say that central banks are like aircraft carriers, so very, very slow to turn. But I don't know, whatever 10 times bigger than an aircraft carrier is, That's what the BOJ has been like. It's like they started moving yield curve control in 2022. And it's been a very, it's been like this paleolithic process of changing policy. And so they've had inflation above target, I think, for 22 months or something like that.
Yeah.
Wage growth is decent. So they have every excuse to hike. One thing I think that is worth keeping in mind for the currency is that people love trading the currency off Bank of Japan. But if you look at what they're actually doing, they're moving rates from negative 0.1 to zero is what the plan is. And bigger picture, that doesn't really change things all that much in terms of investor preferences. So what you tend to see is when the BOJ makes a change, everyone goes nuts in the yen and it leads to tears. For example, in 2016, the Bank of Japan cut to negative rates, which was this epic moment in central banking history. And dollar yen went up for about 6 hours. And that's a weaker yen for about 6 hours. And then the yen rallied for like 6 months after that. So really in the end, to me, the yen is always a global yields trade. And if you look at like how much are US yields moving, they've gone from this year, they've gone from 3.8 to, and then they were at 5 before that. And now they're at 4.1 or something like that. So those are like 80, 90, 100 basis point moves. And we're talking about 10 basis points in the deposit rate in Japan. So I think if you're going to play Bank of Japan, you either have to be very tactical or you play it in the rates market.
Yeah. Talking about rates, by the way, two considerations from my side on Japan. If I look at the forward rates, so basically what the market is pricing for the next 3, 6, 12, 24 months in Japan, at the moment we have for the next year, a whole lot of 30 basis points priced in of hikes, 3-0, that's it. And then 2 years from now, so a long time to go, you have a whopping 50 basis points in total priced. So that's what you have priced in. Now, the reading of this could be that, as you said, Brent, I mean, when you want to play the yen long from an interest rate differential perspective, even if these forwards are realized, 50 basis points are not really going to move the needle that much. The flip side of it could be that the market is only pricing 50 basis point of hikes over the next 2 years. So if Japan would ever seriously consider an exit from negative interest rates and a normalization over time, you might want to argue they could raise rates to maybe 1% rather than 50 basis points. So then
right.
The rates market.
If you have a big picture view that they're going to normalize a lot more, then that could be a huge trade for the yen because the yen is very undervalued. It's gone, dollar yen's gone from 75 to 150. So if they actually normalize the way that people couldn't believe that the ECB would go from zero to four or whatever, it's hard to believe the Bank of Japan is going to go from zero to one or two. But if they do, that will definitely be a game changer because the yen has been this funding currency that it's just always a good currency to be short because it's basically free because interest rates are zero. So if it stopped being a good funding currency, that would be absolutely epic. But I think we're a long way away from that.
Yeah, so I was about to say two more things on Japan, which I think are relevant because we're talking about FX. Let's chat about it. So Japan has been for, I think, a decade, the short side of carry trades in FX, right? So basically where you short something that is very cheap to borrow, the Japanese yen, and you go long stuff that is yielding very nicely. And over the last 2 years, I think the Sharpe ratio, so the return adjusted for volatility of trades like long Brazil short yen has been just ridiculous. I think the total return was like 30-40% up in 2023. That's not a stock, it's an FX pair. It's quite ridiculous, actually. But that also means that probably some of these carry trades are now pretty crowded. Mexico, Brazil, but even, I mean, even stuff like euro yen has been effectively a very good carry trade for the last year and a half or two. So then if Japan would move something, could it be that the unwinding of this carry trade, so the volatility shock that basically hurts these carry trades, could you explain if these dynamics could actually play a role if Japan moves?
So I think that's possible, but I don't think that's the case now because what we've essentially seen is that the pricing has moved. People were expecting a hike in April and now they're expecting it in March. So that hasn't been that big of a change for the curve. But I think if people started expecting much more, like say another hike in October and then another one next April and you know the pricing starts getting a lot more aggressive, then sure. I mean, the hard thing with the carry trades, with going against them, is the reason that they're popular is that they yield a lot, right? So if you want to fight the carry trade, say you want to go short Mexico and long yen, it's just very, very expensive. So every day that you sit there, if it doesn't move, you're losing money. And so your timing has to be absolutely perfect. And the thing that with Brazil and Mexico is there's kind of two kinds of carry trades. There's one where you're just like, okay, I like the carry. Something like Hungary, where you don't really love the fundamentals, or South Africa, but the interest rates are high. So you're just going to be long that currency and, you know, try to navigate whatever political or bad news comes out. But the thing with Mexico and Brazil is that it's kind of like almost a free lunch, because you're getting with Mexico, you're getting the reshoring trade, the move away from China, you're getting strong US labor market features, strong remittances to Mexico, strong US economy is good for Mexico in general. So you're kind of getting a good fundamental story and a good carry trade. So it's just so hard to fight that. So yes, I think it kind of goes to Minsky's stability breeds instability, is that of course, the higher the Sharpe ratio for a carry trade and the longer it's working, the more crowded it'll get by definition. And so that means that at some point there will be this burst of instability, but you really have to be able to time it well, because you can't just say like, hey, it's crowded, I'm going to go short. You have to have some kind of catalyst or some kind of reasoning to think that your timing is going to be correct, because like I said, it's just very, very, it's like being short a stock where the borrow is 8% or something like that. It's just, it's very hard work.
Yeah. And I think this is exactly the reason why the yield curve is not steepening in the US, but it is flattening. Basically, let me try and explain. Steepeners in the US were extremely popular to start the year. So everybody wanted to be in steepeners. The idea would be that the Fed had to cut aggressively, a bit like in 2019. And so the curve would steepen because the front end interest rates would drop more rapidly than the long end. Okay, so a bull steepening with disinflation. This was the major theme. But if you look at year-to-date move in the curve has actually flattened. And, you know, you see a lot of people hating the move. And, you know, they say basically, yeah, it's because the Fed is delaying the moment they start cutting. And so that hurts the front end. And that's why the curve is flattening. But one of the main reason is that a yield curve steepening is a negative carry trade. So basically, you need something to happen. You need a volatility spike somewhere for this steepening to work. Either it's a recession type of data, so then the curve steepens because of that, or it's some sort of the neutral rate is higher, the curve bear steepens, like we have seen it in the last summer. But both events are a volatility event. If those volatility events aren't happening, in other words, if nothing is happening, then the negative carry is quite expensive in a steepener trade. And so you tend to see people unwinding that because, as you say, it's hard to keep having a negative trade, negative carry trade on, unless you're on Twitter, and then you can scream about something for 2 years and then nobody cares because there is no cost of carry on Twitter. But for real traders, it's actually hard.
Yeah. One thing that some funds do is they'll use a technical indicator as an on-off switch so that you're not just sitting there, say with max yen or something like that. If you think it's going to blow up, instead of just sitting there short, which is very expensive, you have some kind of just a basic technical indicator. Like, let's say when it's below or above the 50-day moving average or something like that, and you use that as your on-off switch so that hopefully if it's asymmetric, it's going to go up slowly and it's going to go down super fast.
Yeah.
And so if you use a technical indicator like that, then ideally, then you're with the momentum and you're not just sitting there paying carry. And if you're wrong, it's going to go back on the other side of that indicator at some point. So I think that's a good way to filter negative carry trades, especially, like I said, because they tend to be convex. So if you are buying the break of a moving average and you're right about the convexity, then you're probably going to be in a good spot instead of just sitting there short the expensive thing for month after month.
Yeah, that's a right. That's probably the right way to do it. The type of payoff in this and the timing has to be quite on time. The other last thing about Japan I want to say is that the reason why I personally care about Japan a lot, sure, is the yen, but also it's global bond markets. I mean, Japanese investors have $1 trillion plus of treasuries on their balance sheet, and they have over 400 billion euros equivalent of bonds and French bonds, mostly, anyway, of European bonds in general. So these guys have been accumulating capital surpluses for decades, and they had zero yields at home. So they went and they, you know, bought anything they could outside. And obviously, as you say, Brent, you need to change the picture materially for a Japanese investor to change his preference. I mean, 10 basis points isn't going to make it. But if this hiking cycle would be prolonged over time, then, you know, maybe 30-year bonds in Japan, which today are 1.75%, could be over 2, 2.5%. And then at some point, it starts to make a bit the difference, right? I mean, what is their preference? And also the FX hedging is important because Japanese investors don't just buy treasuries and that's it, but they also have an FX risk to manage. So it's important to monitor both the FX hedging costs and the relative yields between Japanese bonds and treasuries. We are nowhere at a point where it would make the difference yet for Japanese investors, but something to watch because they're big, big whales in foreign bond markets.
You know, I think that's a good point to keep a little bit of imagination, because I think it's easy for me to just be lazy and say, oh, Japanese rates are zero, it doesn't matter, who cares? But that's kind of showing a lack of imagination. And it's also kind of just an extrapolation of what's been going on for my entire career. So just because rates have been zero for my whole life doesn't mean they have to be zero forever. So I think your point is good in that, okay, sure, I still don't think that's going to happen, but I should at least have an open mind and keep that on my radar, because if it does, it's an absolutely epic shift in capital flows for sure.
Yeah, and another epic shift we have seen is that gold is making new all-time highs every day, and Bitcoin has tried to retest its historical all-time high at 69,000. So far, hasn't really breached it yet, but it's getting pretty close to doing that. And I know that you have a certain theory on the dollar, which happens to be the denominator of both gold and Bitcoin, the most used denominator, at least. So what's the story on the dollar?
Yeah, the dollar is interesting right now, because generally my framework has been the US is the global center of innovation. And because it's a net exporter of energy, it really became this all-weather currency. So the general framework that's existed, I think it's Steve and Jen invented it like in 1995 or something, for the dollar that a lot of people look at, which has been useful, is called the dollar smile, which basically means that if things are great in the US or if things are horrible in the US, people buy dollars. So if they're great, then your money flows into the US in happy days. And if it's the end of the world, then people want safe havens and the dollar's a safe haven. And then also the world runs short dollars, like exporters in all the EM countries and all that generally run short dollars. So in a panic, people buy dollars. And then the middle of the dollar smile is when you get global synchronized growth outside of the US and people are investing in other countries besides the US. So the thing is, though, is that in the past, the middle of the dollar smile was accentuated by the fact that the US imported a lot of energy. So if oil went up a lot, you could just sell dollars. It was an easy trade. But now the US is the biggest producer of oil in the world and a net import, or sorry, a net exporter. And so energy prices aren't really correlated with the dollar, and higher oil isn't bad for the US anymore. So it made it harder to find regimes where you want to be short dollars. But the interesting thing right now is we're actually right in the middle of the dollar smile. So the rest of the world equities are outperforming the US. So there was this thing, Tina, which is there is no alternative, which was like a funny catchphrase for like, all you can do is just buy US because everything else is bad. And it's funny because if you ask like 25 people that I trade with, all 25 of them would say Europe is horrible right now. And why are you buying those companies? And like, look at they're like tin can makers and stuff like that, exporters to China, companies that don't have great business models in the current world of high operating margin technology euphoria. But then if you look at what's actually going on, the DAX is performing unbelievably well. You know, Nikkei is absolutely ripping. So there are places to put your money in the minds of people, whatever their reasoning is. And so that has led to some dollar weakness. And really the tell is Bitcoin and gold, because when you have a debasement trade, generally you're going to see the dollar is sort of like the anchor for fiat of the entire world. And so if people think that global policy, whether it's fiscal and monetary combined, is too loose, which obviously people do, then you're going to see gold ripping, Bitcoin ripping, and generally you'll see a weaker dollar in that case, unless it's like a complete capital flow into Mag 7 and all that, which was what we saw for a while. But now we're actually seeing a little bit less of that. So some of the components of like the big mega techs aren't performing as well, like Apple. and DAX is ripping, Nikkei is ripping and all that. So people are finding other places to put their money, which is a dollar down kind of regime. So now what I think is, so non-farms is tomorrow. This podcast will be coming out after that. But I don't think non-farms is really the bellwether or like the game changer. I think CPI released on March 12th is really the most important thing. And I can go into that a little bit, but I'll let you just talk a little bit about the dollar as well.
I think it's quite interesting because the theory behind the smile is backed by the fundamentals of the monetary system. When you have global trade flows slowing down a lot, then you will have all these countries that are leveraged in dollars. So they have about, I think, $12 trillion of dollar denominated debt being issued by entities outside the US, $12 trillion. That's the size, right? So the basically Chinese and Brazilians and everyone else around the world has levered up in dollars because they realized it works. It helps their business models. Hey, they transact in dollars. They sell commodities and goods and services in dollars. So why not lever up? Now, the moment you stop these trade flows, you have a problem accessing dollars because you don't sell anymore in dollars. So then you got to service your debt, and therefore it's a scramble to get your hands on the dollar. So that side of the smile is like basically the deleveraging, the temporary deleveraging of a dollar levered system, of a global dollar levered system. That makes sense why the dollar would rally. And when the dollar, when then the US is strong, sure, then the dollar rallies as well. I think that we are in the middle of the smile, and I agree with you. There is a bit of this animal spirit thing that is probably driving the moving gold and Bitcoin, because if it was really a fundamental middle of the smile thing, then I think people would be more interested in getting after assets that actually produce cash flows. And they are, right, to a certain extent. You know, they're going and buying German equities that, believe me or not, they do produce cash flows. I'm European, so I can say that. Generally, the sentiment around European stocks is horrible the whole time, but they do produce cash flows and earnings, but gold and Bitcoin don't. So then this walks me back to something I wanted to discuss with you, which is, if we have to draw a parallel with the past, what kind of regime are we in? Is this 1995? Is this 2019? In general, in 1995, or even in 2000, if you wish, Fed funds were north of 5%, similar to today. But that didn't nearly stop people from buying assets with no cash flows. So it doesn't have to do with discount rates. So I always hear like gold prices go up because real yields are lower, or Bitcoin goes up because fiat is yielding lower. That's not the case today, guys. You can buy T-bills at 5%. You could do the same in 2007, in 2000, and in 1995. Nevertheless, people bought anything, including assets with no cash flows. I mean, Brent, they're bidding stuff called retardio. It's a coin, you know. There is like the Nancy Pelosi coin making 200% in a week. What's going on? It sounds like animal spirits to me. I mean, the middle of the smile is a nice theory, but is it not like a bit more full-fledged animal spirits what we're looking at?
Well, no, I think you're right. I think it's both. It feels a lot like 2021, where there's a FOMO aspect to everyone. Just feels, I think, correctly, that we're in an era of MMT, which is essentially fiscal deficits don't matter, print the money, let's go kind of thing. And that started in 2017 and accelerated after COVID. And so the only time that it felt like maybe that wasn't the case was 2022, because the pace of rates going up was scary enough that people got out of that. But then as soon as the level of rates didn't matter as much as the velocity, it seemed like. So when the volatility in the bond market settled down and we had certainty on the Fed that they're not going to hike anymore, then people were like, okay, well, we're back. We're still in an MMT world. So fiat is still kind of a bad place to be. So let's buy whatever. And then obviously these, you know, the altcoins and stuff like that is a whole world of its own, but it does require some kind of animal spirits, like you said. And then you'll hear people say, well, the Fed needs to hike. Like, obviously on Twitter, people post some like shitcoin up 9 trillion percent and then say like Fed needs to hike. But I don't think the Fed really looks at financial conditions that way. In fact, like they've said in the past, we can't detect bubbles. We just mop them up after. In the end, also, sometimes they're correct too, is that financial asset prices and consumer prices are not the same thing. So if they were targeting financial asset prices, obviously, I mean, they'd be ripping rates to 8% right now, but they're not. They're targeting CPI. So CPI is going the right way. It's much lower. It's still way above target, but they don't seem to care. So I think you can argue that they went too early, but I don't think you can really argue that they're looking at, you know, Bitcoin and thinking that they should hike. What they're going to look at, the only way I think that any of this financial asset appreciation matters is if it flows through to housing, because obviously housing is a huge component of CPI. And so that will just take a while. So I don't think that looking at financial conditions through the lens of financial asset prices is the right way if you're trying to think about what the Fed is thinking about.
Yeah, I totally agree there. I mean, this idea the Fed is supposed to be more careful because retardio coin is going up. That's not exactly on the monitor of Powell, I would say. And if you ask him, what do you think financial conditions are today? Yeah, he would say, well, corporate borrowing rates are higher and mortgages are higher, and therefore I think conditions are tight.
And right, and I mean, we lifted Fed funds 500 points, so things are tight. And I mean,
so the real question is, when does this change? I mean, like, if you're in a situation, and I think the key word is the predictability of macro, because what assets really hate is vol. Is vol in macro, vol in growth, vol in inflation. That's what they hate the most. Volatility in inflation, volatility in growth. And as long as you're on a predictable disinflationary path and growth is annualized 1.5% real, 2% real in the US, I mean, they will love it, to be frank. And you can talk about the 5% risk-free rate, but if earnings are 5 or 6% in a year and multiples can expand because the predictability of macro is very high, then people are going to buy risk. They're going to buy stocks. And at some point, you can get to stupid levels. There is a very good account on Twitter who covers emerging markets. He's a hedge fund guy, emerging market credit. And he says, we are close to getting to max stupid levels in these credit spreads. Like some Ghana dollar issued bonds are trading in incredibly tight spreads. Spreads close to my world. So the spread between Italian government bonds and German government bonds, the 10-year one, if you don't have it on your dashboard, please put it up. It's 130 basis points, 130. We're talking levels that were reached basically at the full-fledged QE, almost. You know, it's really, really tight. But what's going to stop that? Honestly, you need some ball event. And I don't know when do we get a serious one. Inflation probably, Brent, next week.
Right. So that's the question. So you referred to the 90s before, where the Fed cut three times into a bull market. And it kind of does feel a little bit like that. So people are saying, oh, it's 1999 or 2000, but what if it's 1997? Then you got two more years of this. I mean, I'm not making that call right now, but I mean, I think it's definitely got to be on the bingo card.
Yeah.
So zooming in a little bit, I think this CPI, first of all, disclaimer, everyone always says this is the biggest CPI ever, biggest election ever. That's just human nature. It's like everything feels like the biggest thing ever. But I think this CPI is more important than usual because, like you said, we've kind of got into this more predictable environment where bond market volatility has gone down a lot. Economic volatility has gone down a lot. It's been easier to predict the data points. But then in January, inflation came in quite strong. And there's basically two ways you can look at it. One is, okay, we bottomed out. Inflation in housing is starting to pick up again. Wages are still strong. There's a whole bunch of reasons. If you look at the surveys, pricing power is still kind of a thing for companies. So that's one argument. The other argument is that because of the way that prices are set, so many things will reset on Jan 1. So for example, like your health insurance might reset on January 1. And so there tends to be a lot of price increases on January 1st. Now that should be seasonally adjusted. But in periods of higher than normal inflation, it's really hard to get the seasonal adjustment right because you're just seeing incremental moves that you wouldn't have seen during secular stagnation where there was no inflation. So it's kind of could be a seasonal quirk in the data. So whatever your prior was, if you are an inflationista, then you're like, look, inflation's rising again. And if you're a disinflationista, then you're like, ah, it's a quirk, just forget it. But the thing is, the February data doesn't have that. So I think this February data, which is released on March 12th, will be super important because It won't. I mean, no single data point ever resolves the whole story. You know, it's always this accumulation of many, many data points, but the market doesn't trade like that, right? The market is an equilibrium price based on all the information that exists right now. And then we're going to get new information on March 12th and the market's going to find a new equilibrium. And I think that that data will be super important, because if you're in one of those two camps and then this February data doesn't go your way, then you got to seriously rethink. And that doesn't just mean like intellectually being more flexible, but if you have the disinflation trade on and that data point comes in super strong, then you're like, oh shoot, maybe my thesis is wrong. So I think we could get a pretty big reprice. And given the way that the dollar's trading, given the way global equities are trading, Bitcoin, gold, I think so. If I'm going to do like a trade of the week this week, it's a little bit contingent. So I would say on a weak CPI, sell dollars and ride it for like a month, because I think that will really unleash the disinflationary story once again, which we had a little brief pause on. And the market is just really eager to sell dollars and buy these like debasement trades. So I think then if CPI is weak, you know, Bitcoin will be 370K, gold will be 322.50, and you'll just be selling dollars and making money for weeks.
Wow. Contingent though. So of course the show is released before CPI, so we have no clue. And then if CPI prints 0.4%, please don't kill Brent, because he didn't know and he said contingent on a weak CPI. You can just trend basically this debasement trade and buy assets, speculative assets of any sort, with cash flows, with no cash flows. Pretty much everything is going to work against the dollar, I guess, right? It's an everything rally at that point.
I mean, that's the theory, right? Is that similar to 2021? Yeah, it's the everything. You could call it the everything bubble if you want to be more cynical, or just the everything rally. And I think it is a mistake to just go around calling every bull market a bubble, because yeah, most bull markets are not bubbles.
That's true. So from my perspective, from a trade update perspective, last week we talked about the yen, which was pretty well timed and also lucky, because of course we had no idea about the Japanese headlines. Sometimes
or did we?
Or did we? Ooh, we talk to Japanese people now. But at the end of the day, sometimes you got to be lucky as well. So that's good. I'm still riding Swiss JPY downside. So selling Swiss franc and buying Japanese yen. I mean, these guys are just doing opposite type of monetary policy. It's a very simple trade where I expect the Swiss bank to just, you know, cut slowly but surely and the Bank of Japan to do something different. So I'm happy with just keep riding that trade. And for the rest, to be very frank, there will be a point where vol is going to pick up. And vol can, when I say vol picks up, people always think, oh, it's a bearish call. It means that, you know, we need to sell off and buy puts. But the reality is that vol can pick up on the upside as well. I was asked by a client, you know, hey, is vol cheap or expensive? And if you actually look at the vol priced in calls, well, they're now getting a bit more expensive. But 2 weeks ago, the volatility price in calls was actually way cheaper versus their historical, let's say, type of pricing than the downside vol. I mean, everybody's looking at downside vol and saying it's cheap. Yes, it is. It's definitely cheap. But upside vol, so call volatility, is actually cheaper, historically speaking, or has been cheaper, historically speaking, than downside vol in general.
Well, that was the feature of 2021, right? Was that vol actually was very firm because of all the YOLO call buying. And we haven't even, like, actually me saying YOLO call buying, I think that's the first time I've heard that. And I haven't heard that in this regime yet. So you can easily have the call buying dominates and you have higher vol and higher prices. I mean, that's exactly what happened for a lot of 2021.
Yeah, that's correct. And we are seeing the first signs of that with the, you know, the famous spot up, vol up. So namely, the S&P goes up and the VIX goes up, in a sign that people are buying the upside part of the volatility. So they're buying calls, but they've been buying calls for the whole 2021 and they've been making money for months. So it's not a given that it must stop just because people are showing some signs of excitement on the upside. In general, I wish we get a little bit more vol, because we've had 2 months of what Efficient Market Hype on Twitter will call violently range bound. That's basically what we have had, right? The narrative switches very rapidly from the Fed is going to cut 7 times this year to the Fed is going to cut not even 3 times this year to, oh, wait, we should sell the dollar and buy Bitcoin. And it just jumps back and forth without a clear direction. So maybe we get a macro trend. sooner. Let's have a look. Brent, part of the podcast is also talking about the most stupid thing you've seen and the best thing you've read this week. So what's the most stupid thing you've seen in markets?
I mean, to me, the stupidest thing going on right now is MicroStrategy. So if you make a bunch of assumptions, and if you go on Twitter, you can find a bunch of people doing this in a smart way. It's not that complicated to figure out what is the company worth based on the Bitcoin. And then there's some residual for the software business, which is basically worth like nothing compared to the Bitcoin. If you're buying MicroStrategy now, you're paying more than $100,000 per Bitcoin. Some people say 140K, 120K. And what he's doing, what Saylor's doing is genius. So he issues converts to buy the Bitcoin. And basically he's selling MicroStrategy, and not exactly, but he's selling MicroStrategy or he's selling Bitcoin at 120K and he's buying it at 67K, essentially is a very, very simplified version of what he's doing. And it reminds me a lot of GBTC when it was trading at a massive premium to spot. And there was a reason for that, was that people wanted to buy Bitcoin in 401ks and in the an equity format. So like it was a terrible, terrible idea. But at least there was an explanation for it. With MicroStrategy, you're just buying Bitcoin above 100K for no reason, because there's a spot ETF. So to me, that's the stupidest thing going on. It's not really a convergence trade, because the stupidity can get stupider. But I would just say that buying MicroStrategy makes absolutely no sense unless you want to own Bitcoin at 125,000.
Yeah, it pretty much qualifies as a very stupid thing. The best thing I read this week instead is this. In the late 1990s, there was a certain guy called David Lee Roth. He was the band lead singer, right? And in 1997, he published his autobiography, in which he claimed that the bowl of curated candy had an entirely functional purpose. So let me read you the story. So basically he said, Van Halen was the first band to take huge productions into tertiary, third-level markets. So they pulled like 9 18-wheeler trucks full of gear, a bunch of stuff, like a big, big production facility. So as a little test in the technical aspect of the rider, it would say Article 148, there will be 15 amperage voltage sockets and there will be a lot of technical stuff. And then at some point, there will be something that says there will be no brown M&Ms in the backstage area. No brown M&Ms. It was like buried somewhere in this document, right? And then when the guy would walk on backstage, the first thing he would check is the M&M bowl. And if there would be a brown M&M bowl, then you know you would have to check the entire production, because they didn't read the document. I found that very fun, to be honest.
It's very smart. That was a fantastic album, Jump.
As you can see, my musical culture is horrible. I can only name old Italian songs, and that's it.
Oh boy. Yeah, that was an amazing era of semi-metal. I guess it was like pop metal, hair metal, but Van Halen was amazing back in the 80s.
I only will remember about the brown M&M story. That was very fun. Anyway, buddies, this was it for the week. We'll talk again next week. I'm sure that, Brent, you're not there, right, next week?
That's right. I'm going to be in Canada next week, so you're on your own, or you can find a friend.
Well, I can say something. There are two bold people having this podcast next week. One bold guy with a bold guest as well. Ooh. I'm going to have a bold guest. All right, guys, that was it for the week. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Alf.
The content provided on the Macro Trading Floor podcast is for general information purposes only. No information or other content provided in this podcast should be considered as investment advice. Seek independent professional consultation in the form of legal, financial, and fiscal advice before making any investment decision. Always perform your own due diligence.